This show was first broadcast on Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. For more information on our lineup of shows and the role we play in the media, visit freefm.org.nz.
As young British pilots in Britain from the outset of World War II, they never know for how long they or this war fighting fascism will last. Squadron leader B.J. Allen, as author of Spitfire, these are destined to be his last words in his book published under a nom de plume, B.J. Allen. In fact, there's no such person. Relatives reveal his identity only when wartime censorships ended long after he died on active duty. Published in 1942 by Butler and Tanner, it upholds the censors' deletions of places, identities and ranks an enemy could benefit by knowing, if any, were captured. In the publisher's note, the proofs of this book had to be passed for press subsequent to the author's departure for service overseas. This program is one of a series in Historic Souvenirs, broadcast on Free FM 89.0, proudly supported by New Zealand On Air. The next night, the Germans are active again, and so are we. Two aircraft are dispatched at a time. My turn comes at 11 o'clock. It's another glorious night, and as I take off, I can't help but marvel at the beauty of nature and the evil use man is making of it. There is nothing in the world quite like night flying, and I don't think one can fully appreciate the beauty of a moonlit night save in the air. You seem so much nearer nature herself. And when the clouds cut off the silver light from the earth beneath, to climb up through the white vapour and see it shining like a white carpet below, brings you into a new world, the loveliness and loneliness of which makes you catch your breath in awe. The sound of the engine and the rush of air past the cockpit fade into silence as the spell takes hold. I'm rudely awakened from my thoughts by the insistent voice of the controller asking if I'm receiving him. I come back to earth, as it were, and switch on my transmitter. Receiving you loud and clear. Are you receiving me? Over. An affirmative comes back to me, and instructions for course and height, and I turn onto the given course and begin to climb. Fresh instructions keep crackling in my phones as the controller directs me after a radar. Although I get very close to him, I see no sign of another aircraft. After a while, I'm given a new course, which takes me out to the northeast of the aerodrome. At 15,000 feet, I cruise, following the courses given to me, and then circle as the controller gets me in the path of an incoming radar.
One enemy aircraft approaching you from the east at 15,000 feet.
Okay. Still turning, I strain my eyes towards the east, hoping all the while for a glimpse of a shadowy shape coming towards me. But nothing materializes. Then...
Keep a good lookout. Plus show he's right on top of you.
My heart begins to beat a little faster, and I find myself praying for a glimpse of that German. Still I see nothing, and then comes the anticlimax.
He's past you.
I chase the invisible quarry for several minutes, and then the controller calls me again.
Enemy aircraft has turned away to the north. I don't think it's worth chasing him anymore. Come back and then circle.
Okay. As I turn east again, a line of intensely white flickering light suddenly appears miles away towards the coast. Incendiaries. I watch the lights slowly turn to a steady red glow and know that they have found a mark and have set something on fire. The 4 minutes being up, I circle again, yawning a little as I await more instructions. To the north, another stick of incendiaries suddenly lights up on the dark earth beneath. One by one they flicker out, and the lights die. Good. Those must have been on open ground. A few seconds later, a parachute flare lights up in the sky to the northeast, and then another, and another. I call up on the RT and ask if I can go and investigate.
That's okay.
As I head out towards the flares, there comes a flash and one of them disappears. A gun has opened up from the ground and hit one, putting it out. A few seconds later comes another flash and another flare goes out. In answer, the Germans drop three more and then another three. They seem to have an unlimited quantity of the darned things. I still don't appear to be much nearer the scene of the activity, and at that moment the controller calls me up, tells me to circle at my present position. There's another German coming in very close to me, and I start getting all excited again. I think I've circled for about a minute when a stick of incendiaries appears in the ground almost underneath me. I turn quickly and come round on a course parallel to the line of bombs. I now have a very good idea of where the German is, as a bomb hits the ground only a few hundred yards behind the aircraft, which drops it. In addition to that, I can tell what the raider's course is from the direction of the line of incendiaries. Alas, in spite of all this, I can see nothing. Then behind me, to the north, appears another stick of incendiaries.
Ah, blow the fellow!
He's turned right round. I yank the Spitfire round too in a steep turn after him. It's rather like a game of blind man's bluff, and then to add insult to injury, a stream of big white sparks whizzed past my starboard wingtip.
Tracer!
The blighter's firing at me. Swearing and cursing to myself, I ram the nose down out of the way so that I can see ahead, but he's not there. Just then, the controller's voice tells me that the German's now a mile or two to the west of me. He must have turned round underneath me after he fired. Still feeling furious, I turn west and tear after him, but no, my luck's out. And when he turns to the north, the controller calls up and tells me to come back and land. I glance at the petrol gauge, confirming his suggestion is wise, and I turn on to the homing course he gives me, and I begin to lose height. Corrections of the bearing are passed to me every few minutes, and after a while, I catch sight of the gleam of water below me and recognize the landmark. Another 10 miles, and as I come lower, I pick up the flare path and the aerodrome. At 1,000 feet, I circle the aerodrome, waiting till another Spitfire has landed. Even in good moonlight, and when conditions are favorable, all the senses need to be at the alert. On this occasion, unlocking the hood, I push it back with my elbow until it locks home in an open position. A rush of cold air fills the cockpit, and I lean forward a little to get the utmost protection from the windscreen. My eyes feel tired, and the night air makes them water. I have to keep brushing the tears aside with my glove. Pushing the undercarriage lever out of the top gate, I pull it down until it locks at the end of its travel. The red up of the cockpit indicator going out, to be replaced a few seconds later by a green down as the wheels lock home in the downward position. I throttle back as I come down the left-hand side of the flare path, and as I reach the end, check the speed on the luminous airspeed indicator and pull down the flap lever. The aircraft slows, the nose drops, the flaps come down, and feeling for the rheostat control of the cockpit lights, I turn it until the faint orange glow from the hooded lamp lights up the airspeed indicator and altimeter so I can read them more easily. 110 miles per hour. I put on left bank and turn half a mile from the downward hedge until the nose comes around in line with the flare path. The altimeter shows 300 feet. The needle slowly moving around the dial as I lose height. I see the hedge of the aerodrome boundary quite easily in the brilliant moonlight. The floodlights shine out in front of me, and as the hedge disappears under the leading edge of the wing, I throttle right back and let the speed fall off to 95 miles per hour. The red light, 50 yards inside the aerodrome boundary, flashes past, and then the airscrew lit up like a shining disc. As I pass by the floodlight, and the beam illuminates the aircraft, here comes a bump, then another, followed by a continuous jolting. And we're down. One after another, the lamps of the flare path slip by as I ease on the brakes, and as the aircraft slows right down, turn off towards the dispersal point and taxi to where a dim figure is flashing a guiding torch to show me where to park the aircraft. As I near him, he comes running to meet me and, grabbing the wingtip, guides me in towards a pile of cockpit and engine covers marking my parking place. Braking, I give a burst of throttle and turn the aircraft into wind and switch off, the engine spluttering until, with a final kick, the airscrew stops and all's quiet, save for the whirring of the gyros behind the instrument panel. I climb out and answer the crew's usual inquiry about the aircraft. Yes, everything's okay, thanks. Back to the flight hut to sign up after the flight that everything's in order, then I talk on the phone to the controller about the trip, and then back to the mess hut for a cigarette and some cocoa to flop down in a chair and take my ease until, perhaps, the telephone rings and it'll be my turn to go off again.
Squadrons excel at night fighting. When the moonlight is brightest in March 1941, over a period of 7 nights, we collectively shoot down 35 enemy aircraft. It comes to the end of the moonlight period. Now we are back to patrolling by day with the promise of spring weather. Our aerodrome basks in the noonday sun. When a call comes, it rings in the mess hut. which is not in itself cause for alarm. But the voice is...
30-plus enemy raiders crossing the English Channel. All available aircraft...
All available fighter aircraft to come to a state of readiness. That familiar expression I haven't heard in months. Even as I take the call, I pass this information over my shoulder to the other pilots, whose faces brighten up at the chance of striking the Germans. Seizing the moment, I grab flying kit, ready for such occasion. We're all making for the door when Operations Room sends its next order a minute or so out of the first.
Take off! Take off!
Only 3 minutes later, as the support crew pulled away the chocks, 11 Spitfires are thundering across the aerodrome. Without mine, I'm left wrestling with the reluctant one. It seems like ages to get it coughing into life and firing into action, racing crosswind over the green expanse of aerodrome, lifting off just in time to rise over the far hedge at full power. My aim is to climb up to the other squadrons wheeling about in formation high above me. As soon as my Spitfire reaches theirs, B-Flight forms up on mine, whereupon we and A-Flight climb hard after the Czech squadron, which leads the operation. We're rising fast into the dome of heaven, with southeast England laid out like a map beneath. Visibility must be at least 100 miles. A broken layer of white, fleecy clouds at 3,000 feet, speckling the sunlit earth and blue waters of the North Sea with endless shadows. It's the sort of day when we thank God to be alive, and yet here are we going as fast as we can in the hope of getting a chance of killing Germans, and yet we'd be cleansing the earth in doing so, that we and many millions of others can enjoy the cleanness of nature on just such a day as this. I'm not of a religious nature, but I do have a bit of conscience. Cowardly hypocrites cling to the commandment, thou shalt not kill. Baloney! We're now at 18,000 feet, almost over the Thames estuary, with the others a couple of miles ahead and a couple of thousand feet higher. I hear the voice of the English CO of the leading squadron, perturbed by white condensation trails they're creating. The plumes behind the aircraft disclose the strength, direction and height of the fighter formation. As I watch, the leading Hurricane aircraft reduce their altitude till their condensation trails cease. Updating the intelligence, the controller's voice comes over the RT to report...
Enemy aircraft to the south.
I see their smoke trails weaving about higher up out to sea. I wonder if it may be a decoy designed to draw us away from the shipping we're to protect on the Thames. As the unidentified aircraft pass over us, sun glinting on their wings as they bank, discloses reassuring red, white and blue rondels. They're ours, Hurricanes! Up and down we go, tacking when we face the sun, ensuring that its blinding light is never at our tails. We spot no enemy coming across the channel, despite squinting into the sun, scanning the sky for something suspicious. Nothing. The controller, convinced there's no imminent threat, concludes our mission. From our lofty altitude, without land reference points, only the dial of the rate of climb and descent conveys an accurate idea. Its needle shows I'm going down at the rate of 2,000 feet a minute. Soon my ears sing. Sounds like I'm going deaf. It's the familiar effect of quickly increasing atmospheric pressure as I encounter lower levels. To counter it, I push finger and thumb in the top of my oxygen mask, pinch my nose, and blow till both ears crack, bringing noise back in a rush, restoring normal hearing. I do this every few thousand feet descent. I strike disturbed air currents at the top of clouds. At 4,000 feet, my steady dive becomes bumpy close to clouds. They rush to meet us, envelop our flight, darker as the ground looms in view. It's a zone where air eddies toss the Spitfire about, with its joystick correcting the wing, dipping first one side, then the other. I'm looking out for a familiar landmark. The upper sections of the flight close up on me in tight formation. Now we're nearly home. Ah, that stream by the railway. Now, a copse of trees. That's just south of our aerodrome. Half a mile away, a dozen hurricanes emerge from cloud, doing likewise. The RT ground station, aware we're over our base, clears us to land. I come in first, followed in quick succession by the rest of our flight, and finally by A flight. I taxi in, wave away the other aircraft in my section, each to its own dispersal point, switch off, climb from the cockpit, walk to the flight hut to sign off for the flight, light a cigarette, and wait for the others to come in. Then it's back to the mess for a welcome drink before lunch. We might have better luck on duty in the afternoon. This is as far as the diary of the squadron leader takes us. The pages of this book, Spitfire, published posthumously, paint the picture of a man dedicated to doing his duty, modest but determined to highlight the extreme danger the Allies' air forces face in the skies above Britain when German invasion was an ugly prospect. His experiences early in the Second World War appeal to patriotic instinct, so making his book Spitfire consistent with the war effort and recruiting for the RAF. But the rules surrounding wartime censorship suppressed the identities, places, and dates of many events blanked out in the book.
So give a rousing cheer, the British planes are here.
As to the author's identity, his nephew, living in Hamilton, Peter Lane, says the family in England has a brief but trustworthy source to rely on, which reveals the following facts. Regarding the death of Brian Lane, on 13th of December, 1942, at the age of 25, whilst piloting a Spitfire, he was shot down by Luftwaffe pilot Walter Leonard in a Focke-Wulf 190 over the North Sea, 20 miles west of Schoen Island in the West Frisian Islands of the Netherlands. Brian's body was never recovered from the North Sea, the best information available through official channels. This is the final adaptation from the book Spitfire, published in London in 1942, when World War II was still raging. The book, based on actual events, is written by an RAF airman early in the war. It had to pass the censor's rulings. This it did, once many identifying details had been deleted. for example, the author stated in the book to be Squadron Leader B.J. Ellen, is a nom de plume. The actual author is, in fact, Squadron Leader Brian Lane.
I love you, there's nothing to hide. It's better than burning inside. I love you, no use to pretend. There, I've said it again. I've said it, what more can I say? Believe me, there's no other way. I love you, I will to the end. There, I've said it again. I've tried to drum up a phrase that would sum up all that I feel. But what good are phrases? The thought that amazes is you love me, and it's heavenly. Forgive me for wanting you so. But one thing, I want you to know, I've loved you since heaven knows when. There, I've said it again.
In the series Historic Souvenirs, welcome next week to extracts taken from another book with Waikato connections. Historic Souvenirs is a program broadcast weekly on Free FM 89.0, which is proudly supported by New Zealand On Air. Cheerio.
Forgive me for wanting you so, but one thing, I want you to know, I've loved you since heaven knows when. There I go, there I've said it again. Episodes
use the accessmedia.nz app for iOS and Android devices, or subscribe to this podcast via Spotify, iHeartRadio, or Apple Podcasts. This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.